The action underway in a federal courtroom where the Apple ebook price-fixing case takes place is proving to be a case study in creative legal maneuvering. Welcome back to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. My name is Christopher Keneally for Beyond the Book. Andrew Albanese of Publishers Weekly is our man in that Manhattan courtroom, but if Apple gets its way, he could be headed west. Hello there, young man. How are you?
Hey there, Chris. How are you?
I'm okay. You'll be the young man headed west if the Apple folks get their way. So tell us what's going on there. This is another interesting turn in a case that's full of them.
That is true. So, yeah, I think it's no secret to our listeners that Apple has not fared so well before Judge Denise Code here in New York City, even though from my usual seat in that Manhattan courtroom, Code's been pretty fair and pretty efficient in moving the case. But nevertheless, she easily found Apple liable at its price-fixing trial, and has pretty much denied them any quarter in the pretrial actions of its damages trial. For example, she denied its rather lazy proposed schedule, for example. Well, this week, Apple argued that Judge Code actually does not have jurisdiction over its damages trial. According to Apple, there was never an order consolidating this action for trial, only for pretrial activity. And since the pretrial activity is almost over, the case should be remanded back to their original courts. And that would mean for the class action, right in Apple's backyard in Northern California, and for the state action, that would be West Texas. So, you know, whether you believe Apple is guilty or not, you have to hand it to their lawyers. They really are giving them a first-class defense here. And this motion, I think, is another example of that. Now, it could easily be denied, but that would just generate another appeal. And if this change of venue is granted, it would then mean more time to get the courts up to speed. It would mean more venues and a harder fight to coordinate for all the plaintiffs, which have closely coordinated their cases thus far. And of course, with the multiple venues, you can get differing results, which leads us to more appeals. So, you know, if this works, it could really buy Apple a lot of time and perhaps draw them a fresh set of judicial eyes, maybe more than one set of judicial eyes. So, you know, I'm not so sure it is going to work. You know, looking at the court documents, it would seem to me that in one of the many pretrial management conferences, Apple probably may have waived its right to have the case returned to its original jurisdictions, but we'll see.
Well, indeed, we will see. And certainly, as you point out, Apple is getting what it's paying for. They can certainly afford a first-class defense, and no doubt they are paying for that. So they have filed that motion. They've also filed an appeals brief in the Second Circuit. And in essence, this appeal says that Judge Code, who you admire, well, according to Apple, she's just bungled things.
That's right. And that is really it in a nutshell. Apple did file its appeal before the Second Circuit. And you're right. It all boils down to this. Judge Denise Coate, Apple says, totally blew it. In its appeal brief, it argued that Coate relied on too many inferences from too much circumstantial evidence, and that led her to clearly err in finding that Apple was the ringmaster of a conspiracy with five publishers to inflate ebook prices. Now, generally, cases on appeal tend to hinge on legal and procedural errors rather than relitigating findings of fact. In this appeal, however, Apple leans really hard on the merits of Judge Code's fact findings, and it argues that evidentiary rulings can be reviewed for an abuse of discretion, and in this case, you know, Coate's pervasive misreading of the evidence is that abuse of discretion. Thus, it meets the standard for review at the Second Circuit. The clearest error, Apple argues in its brief, is that Judge Coate was able to infer a conspiracy from the voluminous but largely circumstantial evidence in the case. The evidence is at best highly ambiguous, Apple argues, and legal precedent limits the inferences that a court can make in such cases, or so Apple would have us believe. And if that sounds familiar, it should, because Apple's argument in its appeal brief is almost exactly what it argued at trial and in its closing arguments at trial. Apple even argued once again that its entry into the market is pro-competitive, that it even saved Barnes & Noble, which, you know, I think that's nice that Apple wants to save Barnes & Noble because it looks like Barnes & Noble could use the help, frankly. In its appeal, Apple also asserts that Judge Coate erred in deeming a case a per se violation. And that means it was so clear a case that the law would have precluded the court from considering reasons why the defendants might have undertaken the actions that they did. And Apple also wants the court to look at Coates' handling of the evidence, and also they think her final order is out of bounds. But, you know, let's cut right to the chase here. Apple's appeal hopes all boils down to this one difficult task. Its attorneys must now lead the Second Circuit to a completely opposite finding than that slam-dunk verdict Judge Coates came to in just 20 days. And they have to do that based on the same record and with just a single brief oral argument before the Second Circuit. So how tough a task is that going to be? Well, I think it's going to be very tough. I spoke to a few lawyers, and the consensus is that the Second Circuit may find a lot of what Apple is casting as questions of law in its appeal as unreviewable fact findings. Christopher Sagers, an antitrust lawyer at antitrust law professor, I should say, at Cleveland State University, told me that he thinks Apple's most fertile challenge is going to be whether this is a per se case. But even if the court finds that Coates erred in dubbing this a per se case of price fixing, the Second Circuit is still likely to affirm, he says, because Coates held in her ruling that Apple would have been liable had that been the standard. Now, anything can happen on appeal, so I'm not about to write Apple off. But I think, you know, I find it hard to believe that a judge as experienced as Denise Coates could blow a case as badly as Apple's brief suggests. But then again, this is not unprecedented. And here's an example. In 1997, a district judge ruled in favor of the New York Times in the Paramount Digital case of our time, which is Ticini versus New York Times, a case that I know, Chris, you know intimately. In issuing a summary judgment ruling, the judge in that case held that electronic databases were, in fact, revisions of published periodical articles. The Second Circuit reversed that with this blunt assessment: the district court is wrong. And that's a quote. So the Second Circuit reversal was upheld on appeal all the way to the Supreme Court. So indeed, the district court in that case did prove to be wrong. Nevertheless, that wayward district judge also made it to the Supreme Court. So does Sonia Sotomayor. So, Apple, there is hope. Even great judges can totally blow cases.
Well, that's fascinating. Sonia Sotomayor figuring in all this, and who would have thought? But, you know, creativity isn't limited entirely to the legal space when it comes to writing up interesting proposals. And in the case of Barnes & Noble, which you mentioned there, there has been some creativity in the news regarding them. Tell us what's happening.
Yeah, well, Barnes & Noble's, depending on what you believe, is in play. Well, you know, maybe sort of in play. Last week, a company called G Asset Management, which is a venture cap firm, made a bid for 51% of Barnes & Noble. But in a conference call this week, new BNN CEO Michael Huseby quickly shot the offer down, pointing that even in its offer letter, the proposal from G Asset Management acknowledged that it did not have the financing in place to make the offer right now. And he also said that BNN has no plans to take on any action on the proposal at all. So that appears to be sort of, you know, on hold or possibly dead in the water at this point. But Huseby in the call then went on to talk about BNN was planning to do on the heels of its recently announced declining revenues yet again. He talked about the downsizing of the Nook division and at the same time about the need for the company to maintain a presence in digital reading in the digital reading device market and to reverse its ominous slide in digital content sales. Huseby also acknowledged the possibility that the company may yet still be broken up. So these are very interesting times for BNN. You can read all about it on the PW site, where we follow this very closely. And it's also nervous times, I think, for publishers. So, you know, there's surely to be more to come, and you can stay tuned on the PW website for all those developments.
Yeah, indeed we will. And, you know, it's nearly the end of February. Spring is on the horizon. Can't come any fast enough for those of us in the Northeast. But there's reason for optimism in the book business as well. And tell us about that.
I love the spring metaphor. That's great. No, indeed, it's not bad news out there at all. And in Monday's issue, we have our annual fastest growing independent publisher spotlight. And, you know, I won't give too much away here, but the 11 companies that made this year's list are a mix of first timers and repeat performers. In fact, there are four companies that are reappearing on the list after falling off for a year or two. There are three fastest growing companies from 2012 who made it back in 2013. And here's the big teaser. The fastest growing publisher on the PW fastest growing independent publisher list in 2013 is not only making its first appearance, but also represents the first time that a company headed by a self-published author has hit the list. So check out the feature in Monday's issue of PW to find out who that is and to see the other 10 companies that made the list.
Well, we will do that and check out all the reporting in PW this week. And Andrew Albanese, as always, we thank you for joining us on Beyond the Book.
My pleasure, as always.
Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, find us on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, copyright.com/Beyond the Book. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.